from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, we dissect last night's presidential debate, the first of election 2016. Hillary Clinton put her debate opponent Donald Trump on the defensive, hitting him on his tax returns and comments about women.
This is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs.
Trump, who today is blaming a defective microphone for criticism of his performance, challenged Clinton on her record.
And Hillary, I just ask you this. You've been doing this for 30 years. Why are you just thinking about these solutions right now?
We check in with political commentators in the hour ahead about who performed well and who fell flat during the highly anticipated matchup, and we want to hear from you. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last night, a 90-minute debate took place at Hofstra University between Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton and Republican nominee Donald Trump, moderated by NBC News anchor Lester Holt. In this opening hour of Forum this morning, we assess the debate with three leading political analysts, and let me tell you who we have lined up here to talk about the debate, and of course we want to hear from you as well. I want to welcome James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, author of China Airborne. Good to have you with us. Welcome, James Fallows.
Hello, Michael. Nice to talk to you.
And we also have Bruce Kane with us, who is professor of political science at Stanford. Bruce Kane, good to have you aboard.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And good morning, we'll say, also to Deborah J. Saunders, who is here with us in studio, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, whose column is nationally syndicated. Deborah Saunders, good to have you aboard.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to everybody. And let's begin, if I may, Jim Fallows, with you. You had, as you do every 4 years, a rather extensive and, I must say, yeoman work preview of the debates, as well as looking back and looking forward. And it was on the Atlantic cover, Who Will Win the Debates? Well, I've read your most recent column, and from your perspective, it seems that you give the nod to Hillary Clinton, a very strong nod, I might add.
What was remarkable to me watching in real time last night was how almost everything that Hillary Clinton's team had prepared for and hoped for happened the way they wanted, and almost everything that Donald Trump's supporters might have feared also occurred just that way, too. I think the most important was that one – actually, I would say two important things. One was that Hillary Clinton succeeded in baiting Donald Trump, of getting him to sound intemperate or talking over the others, whether it was about the Iraq war or about his business practices or almost anything. The other was that Trump was not able to maintain what I think the Democrats were afraid of, which was a sort of serene presidential-type demeanor. I'll just wrap this up by contrasting this to the 1980 debate between then-incumbent President Jimmy Carter, my one-time employer, and then-California governor, former Governor Ronald Reagan, where the question about Reagan was he presidential in demeanor? And after their debate, I think many people thought that. I don't think many people watching this debate last night felt that Donald Trump increased his presidentialness in demeanor.
And did he in any way, or did she in any way, really move the needle, though, in terms of winning over those people that they were after winning over? I mean, how do you measure that, and do you think that is indeed the case?
That's impossible to know. And as you know, there's a whole, as my old graduate school classmate Bruce Kane will no doubt point out, political scientists debate whether whether presidential debates actually determine elections. We can't tell. But if you start with the proposition that neither Hillary Clinton nor especially Donald Trump has enough support locked in right now to carry the Electoral College, then the challenge for each of them is to appeal to people who are not yet decided. And I think she may have had more success doing that than he did. I'm sure his existing supporters felt he did well. The question is whether anybody not already on his team would be drawn by the performance last night.
Let me just follow up on that for a moment with you, Jim, because initially they were talking about prosperity and jobs in the first part of the debate. And she did, it seemed to me, try to appeal to the millennials and to the Bernie Sanders supporters by talking about profit sharing and economic equality and actually free college, debt-free college, and yet did not sustain it. And that was a bit of a surprise to me because she, like you said, seemed to hit all of her other major points. But what also was a surprise was really not going after Trump's not going after her on many things that Benghazi, for example, or he did mention the emails, but in response to her mentioning his tax returns. In other words, there were many ways that he could have gained ground with his own supporters that he didn't seem to take up.
Yes, and I think it's the first third of the debate, as you point out, there was some actual something like substantive focus from both of them, where Donald Trump was talking about the evils and destruction of trade deals, and Hillary Clinton was talking about her economic vision in various ways. And I think if she did not emphasize that in the final 60 minutes, I think that's largely because at that point the debate lost anything like a sort of narrative coherent frame. Mainly because Trump was going off in so many different directions, and she was largely parrying him from that point onwards and also trying to provoke him. I think effectively, I'm sure his supporters think that he held up well, but I think such substantive focus as there was economically in the first third.
Again, James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, author of China Airborne. I'm going to go to Deborah Saunders next, who's here with us in studio, because I think she sees things quite differently than Jim Fallows does. I mean, particularly, I mean, the headline of your column today was Trump won the night.
I think he did. And I think Hillary Clinton did a fine job. She was able. She showed command of the issues. One of her better lines was when she looked at him and said, you seem to be making fun of me for preparing for the debate. Well, guess what? I prepared for the presidency. She wanted to make sure that people saw him start to lose his temper. He didn't take it as far as he has before. And she wanted to remind people of the dim view that Donald Trump often has of women. He judges them by their looks. And that's basically it. But I think that Trump carried something that will last in people's minds. So whatever you might think today, I think that the message that he had was, hey, America, you've got $20 trillion in national debt. What do you have to show for it? Yeah, Hillary, maybe I didn't pay my taxes, but you would have squandered it. And I think that given the mood of the country today, that will carry the way. And, you know, for people who don't know, I don't expect to vote for Donald Trump. I expect to vote for Gary Johnson. So this, I am not.
Even though he never heard of Aleppo and has kind of, shall we say, almost embarrassed himself on talking about nobody hurt with the bombs that went off in New York.
There are no good choices in this election. I think that's the thing that's really clear about this. I mean, I never thought Donald Trump could win the GOP nomination. I compared him to I thought he was the GOP's Voldemort. He should not be named, so I'm not a fan. But I felt that he has tapped into something, and it just as I never thought he could win the Republican nomination, I look at the fact that he's doing pretty well with Hillary right now. And obviously, there's a reason for it. And it may not be something that a lot of your listeners agree with, but the fact that he has barely spent anything, and he has no organization, and he's close to even with Hillary Clinton, that should scare a lot of people.
And also, I think, as you pointed out in your article this morning, he seems to be appealing for all of his perhaps temperament problems that came through, or his problems with demeanor and the rest of it. And there have even been some things that have come up subsequent to the debate today, as far as that whole issue is concerned, which I hope we can touch upon. But what you're saying is people don't want the status quo. And they see Hillary Clinton, he mentions 30 years and all this debt and so forth, and it resonates for them.
That's right. And so when she talks about, I've spent all these years preparing, and he says, but what did we get for it? And I think there are a lot of people who feel that Washington doesn't work for them, that people in the State Department are too busy trying to please other nations and not trying to please Americans at home. That's what he tapped into.
And let me go to Bruce Cain on all of this. Again, Bruce Cain is professor of political science at Stanford, and interested in hearing your reading about last night, Bruce. I mean, you can talk about winning and losing and sometimes the lack of the needle being moved, but clearly they were after getting more support from specific people they needed support from, Hillary Clinton, from perhaps suburban women and, well, more moderate Republicans. Trump from, well, I suppose he has been at least looking for people of color to get behind him. In terms of how you measure this, again, was the needle moved by either of them?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to know until we get more scientific polls, but my guess is probably not very much, because this is an election where a lot of people know both of the candidates very well and have pretty good views of where they stand on these candidates even before the debate began. But I do think there are some swing groups out there, and I think that maybe Hillary missed some opportunities to really go after the working class voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and the Rust Belt states, because I do think the first part of it, of the debate last night, and I think both Jim and Deborah said this, was not the best time for her. She didn't really come back as sharply on why NAFTA wasn't the big disaster that Trump is saying. She didn't really come into talking about what the Democratic Party can do for the working class, because in reality, I think our two parties have become parties of the middle class, different elements of the middle class. But I don't think she, and it's surprising to me that she didn't come back on this issue a little bit with something more interesting or novel or strong to say about that, because she just came out of a primary where she was forced by Sanders to talk about the problems in these states and the problem that's going to happen if we go forward with the Clean Power Plan. There are going to be industries in coal industry, et cetera, that are going to get hurt. And it's not all because of regulation. It's also because of market forces. But, there's got to be an answer to that. It can't simply be appealing to the middle class. It just seemed to me her approach is kind of 90s approach of talking about middle class, middle class, middle class. I think there's this missing constituency that Trump has somehow tied to the Republican Party that the Democratic Party really has to think about getting back into its ranks.
Was there a defining moment of the debate in this long campaign for you, Bruce Cain? For either candidate?
I don't think. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there has been so far. I mean, I think it's we're going to go into a much more negative period. You can see this already in what Trump has suggested after this last debate. And so we're going to be into a war of attrition where both sides are going to be tearing each other down even more than they have already. And the question is then who's actually going to show up? Who's going to be left standing? Who's going to actually come to the polls and feel like they have to be there? And I do think that the critical people will be people like Deborah Saunders. It'll be people who are in favor of rational debate, in favor of facts, in favor of, a person who's prepared for the presidency, but, are faced with a choice that they find unpalatable. And, and it's to date, we haven't seen. Because what's happening with Trump's numbers is that the number of registered Republicans who are supporting him has gone up. It's up near 90% right now. So there's this kind of discrepancy between very visible people who have said they're not going to vote for Trump. But now we see Ryan praising Trump's performance last night. We see Ted Cruz switching over and endorsing him. So, it really raises this critical question. It's not just the independent voters. It's also what do some of these college-educated Republicans who really think that Donald Trump is not a good example for their children, is not really well prepared for the presidency. What are they going to do on election day? Are they going to just not vote for the president? Are they going to vote for a minor party? Or are they going to go along with the party line? And I think that's going to be an issue that may not get decided until actual election day.
Well, what are your thoughts about last night's debate? We do want to hear from you and want to have you weigh in here, and you indeed have the opportunity to do that right now. I want to give you our toll-free number and extend the invitation for you to join the program. The toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. So feel free to join the program now. Again, it's 866-733-6786. And there are other ways that you can indeed be a part of this program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website and letting us know what's on your mind there, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to join us talking with Bruce Cain, Deborah Saunders, and James Fallows about the debate last night. And I had been talking about the morning after the debate. Donald Trump did actually lash out at Lester Holt, whom he had labeled as a Democrat, when Lester Holt indeed is a Republican. He complained about his microphone, threatened to make Bill Clinton's marital infidelity a campaign issue in a television appearance just hours after his first presidential debate, and also seemed to be exercising strong words for that young Latina Miss Universe contestant, Alicia Machado, who was brought up by Hillary Clinton as someone who he had said rather unflattering things about her weight and so forth. I'm wondering, Jim Fallows, what kind of effect does that sort of thing you think is going to have on the population, particularly on fence sitters?
So part of the discussion recently in the show has been about the election as a whole and part about the debate, just talking about the debate dynamics of the last 24 hours and the aftermath. It was striking to me first that in the Republicans who in the spin room exercise last night, you had Rudy Giuliani saying, well, the next one will be better. You had Corey Lewandowski starting to complain about the moderation by Lester Holt. That is signs that they recognize they had not been able to get done what they might have hoped by Donald Trump. The Miss Universe controversy in a way reminds me of the Khan family controversy that Donald Trump got into after their family, of course, was speaking at the Democratic convention in this sense. When you have an issue you think is not going to be a winning one for you in politics, you do what Hillary Clinton actually got away with last night, which is talking about her emails in one sentence, saying, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, that's it. And she for better or worse, did not need to go back to the rest of the debate. What you don't want to do is to draw something out and make it a several-day story. And I think that on this morning's show, Trump saying, well, this woman, she was really overeating, it was a terrible problem. This will become a several-day story on an area that is not good for him, of generally, you know, the question of telling women they are overweight. That's not a way to build for somebody in his position to broaden his appeal in that way. So I think, again, if the barometer is people in groups Trump knew he needed to expand his appeal to, are the things he's done the last 24 hours likely to expand that appeal? And my guess, whether we're talking about Latinos or African Americans or women or educated whites, I don't think in any of those grounds areas you can say, boy, he moved ahead rather than staying even or moving behind.
Let me go back to the debate last night with you, Deborah Saunders. I mean, all of those facial expressions and the coughing and wheezing and whatnot, these things do matter as we face. It should be the policies, obviously, where the focus ought to be. But as we found in past debates, they do matter. And you know, I was thinking Trump was constantly interrupting when Hillary accused him of stiffing people who work with him. She mentioned an architect in the audience. He said maybe he didn't do a good job. Put that against his talk about law and order and his talk about, you know, the fact that the police have all fraternal order of peace come out behind him and supported him. Admirals have come out and supported him, generals and everything. There's a kind of balance there that one has to work through or navigate through. In other words, he's appealing to the base with those, and he's also saying, look, I'm the law and order guy, like Nixon did.
And I'm the guy who, if you screw up, I'm not going to pay you your full amount. And people are feeling, they look at what happened with the government and it's not doing it, and I think that actually works. Let me tell you the moment I thought that was the most interesting in the debate, and that is when the tax returns came up. And Hillary Clinton said, and I think this is he's very vulnerable on this issue. She said, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. And maybe he doesn't give to charity as much as he says he does. And these devastating Washington Post stories by David Fahrenholt about how little Trump has given to charity, how the Trump Foundation actually has been giving away other people's money. He hasn't given to his own namesake foundation since 2008. All of this tells me, gee, he said he was under-leveraged in the debate, but I think he's over-leveraged. Maybe he doesn't have nearly as much money as he says. And if that's true, then everything about the whole cookie can crumble, right? And she said, and maybe you don't pay your taxes. And that's when he pivoted and he said, that's right, maybe I didn't. Instead of saying, no, but I did.
Well, he also at one point talked about, well, that's good business in effect.
And you would have squandered it. And I just think that was just a brilliant moment of jujitsu.
Well, Lester Holt asked Trump why he wouldn't release his tax returns, even though the IRS says it's fine for him to release them under audit. Let's hear what Hillary Clinton said in response. Cut to.
Why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. He didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if
me
he's
smart.
Paid zero.
I will release my tax returns when she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted. As soon as she releases them, I will release. I will release.
Well, Bruce Kane, there was real locked horns. And who do you think came out really looking better for a wider audience than that?
You know, I keep having this problem, which is I think that the way discourse is working in this country right now, people see the same facts in completely different ways because of the sort of ideological and partisan screens they have. So, you know, to me, that exchange very much went to Hillary. But I'm tempered my judgment by understanding, because I talked to my relatives who are red state Oklahoma Trump supporters, that I don't completely understand how other people take the same facts and interpret them. So, I mean, I think he came back by switching the grounds on to emails. And that, you know, so it's like two people talking past each other. And I suspect we're going to see a lot of that. And that's really what we have as a dialogue in America right now, people talking past each other.
Well, I also wanted to single out and get your response, Bruce, to Lester Holt asking candidate Trump why his judgment is better than Hillary Clinton's. And let's hear this in Cut 7.
I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament. I have a winning temperament. I know how to win. She does not have
Secretary
how to win.
Clinton.
Wait, the AFL-CIO the other day, behind the blue screen, I don't know who you were talking to, Secretary Clinton, but you were out of control. I said, there's a person with a temperament that's got a problem.
Secretary Clinton.
Woo! Okay.
Yeah, another one of those moments, Bruce Cain, where I suppose depending on who you're supporting and who you are rooting for, you see it completely differently. What did you make of it?
Well, to the normal observer and the normal rules that you know, we operate on, Trump stepped on his message by answering intemperately about temperament. So in that should be a problem. But again, it's hard to say. I think there are a lot of people on the Republican side who are absolutely outraged by everything the Clintons have done and the way they behave, and who see in the media people that are protecting them. And so, you know, when he comes back and mentions the emails, yeah, that's sort of switches the grounds in their minds. And that's really the more important issue. So, again, the polls indicate that a fair amount of the voting going on this time, and I bet it'll even increase over time, is about preventing the other person from getting into office. It's not so much that they love Trump. Trump's problems are widely known. Pretty much every poll indicates that people have a lot of questions about his preparedness, about his temperament, about his lifestyle. But a lot of people are saying, yeah, but, you know, I don't want the Clintons in power again. I don't want the policies they're going to pursue. I don't think I can trust them. I don't like them. And so it's, you know, question of the lesser of two evils in their mind. And where you are on what you think is an evil depends a lot upon your ideological frame.
And though he didn't hit on a lot of things he could have hit on, as I said earlier, I mean, he never mentioned the wall, for example, which obviously appealed to a lot of his supporters and his base. He did keep talking about 30 years, as if Secretary Clinton had to answer for three decades. I'm going to go to a break now, but when we return, we will hear from you, our listeners, and I remind you that you can join us a number of ways. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do want to hear from you, and we'll hear more from our guests. We have Bruce Cain with us, and James Fallows, and Deborah Saunders. I want to get in more, of course, to the content and the policy of what you heard last night between the two candidates. Stay tuned for that, and again, you can also join us by going online, KQED.org/forum, or calling us when lines become available, toll free 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As you might expect, we are discussing the debates last night that took place between the two candidates of the major parties, Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side and Donald Trump on the Republican. Deborah Saunders is with us in studio, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, whose column is also nationally syndicated. And Bruce Cain with us by phone is professor of political science at Stanford. We also have James Fallows with us, national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of China Airborne. And we're getting a lot of tweets here. Let me just read a few of them. Deborah tweets, "My millennial son, a very lukewarm Clinton supporter, stated he was more excited and comfortable with her after the debate." Jason tweets, "Presidential debates test who America can trust in office. She stayed cool. He didn't. He's a salesman, but she is a closer." And another listener tweets, "Trump was incoherent as the debate went on. Did no one notice that?" Sean writes Clinton probably did better, but neither one did what they really needed to do this debate. Trump didn't sound presidential. Clinton didn't open up and continues to remain guarded and impersonal. The American people were the ones who lost the debate. I was a little bit surprised. Maybe I get a comment from you on this, Bruce Kane. Chuck Todd remarked that he thought there was really very little substance in this debate and the American people were therefore the losers as he saw it. But I thought, in fact, that the things lined up so much and so strongly, particularly on, so many issues. I mean, you know, who was for or against the Iraq war? Trump again saying that he had long been against it, which I think has been proven to be a misstatement or a lie. But also about the Iran treaty, which Trump was inveighing against, not only on foreign policy, stop and frisk. You know, they seem to really bat heads on a lot of those issues, trickle-down economics. There was substance there, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, I agree that they covered a lot of topics, and I certainly think the first part of the debate was more substantive and, you know, actually talked about serious issues that are in people's minds. I mean, there were some topics that they didn't get to, but there are two other debates. We didn't really get into issues about, as you said before, the wall or immigration, et cetera.
Or Wall Street.
Yeah, there you go. But look, I think what happened was as the debate went forward, I think it is fair. Jim said this, and I think he's exactly right, that Trump took the bait. And so we got into an increasingly personal discussion where he was defending himself at length and interrupting. So he lost his cool. And so the substance kind of got subsumed under all the froth of, allegations back and forth. It's hard to say. I don't think he's going to be any more substantive going forward. I think he came out of this and listening to the interviews today with the belief that he's just got to hit her harder. And so I think it's going to be very hard to keep these candidates on a particular topic. Hillary has the problem that she tends to do a list of things she wants to do. She doesn't sort of give the underlying logic of what her approach is to take care of people that feel threatened by terrorism or feel threatened by immigration. She doesn't have her husband's ability to distill what it is that's really on people's minds and in language that they can understand. And so even though there's a lot of substance to discuss, it's kind of a list of things rather than a real kind of hard-hitting argument. And Trump just gets distracted, and they did their homework on how to get him upset, and it worked. Now the question is, you know, can Trump maintain any discipline in the next two, debates, or is he going to be sort of like he was at the end?
Let me go to your calls, and let's begin, Colin, with you. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is for Ms. Saunders. President Obama currently has an approval rating of 58%. How does Trump's dredging up the whole birther nonsense last night and then refusing to apologize to the president for what is indisputably a racist lie affect Trump's standing with independent voters?
It doesn't.
Deborah Sons, yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I've been appalled at his behavior on birtherism, but it hasn't hurt him. I don't know what to say. People have – he's got a very low bar.
It's a Teflon effect on that score, certainly.
I don't know what to say. You know, the problem that we have is that we have two candidates people don't like. Democrats don't like Hillary Clinton, too. It's not just Republicans who don't like her. There are a lot of Democrats who look at her and don't like the package. So you've got two – it's really who do you hate the least?
Yeah, but a lot of African-American voters, for example, who might even, I don't know, be wooed by Trump in some way when he says, what do you got to lose or something like that, mm-hmm. They look at something like the birther issue and it's very different than those who, you know, don't see it at all because of their blindness or their allegiance to Trump or being lemmings or whatever you want to call it or just believing in him.
I think he's going to have a lot of trouble getting black votes. No question about it.
Let me bring some more of your calls on and let's go next.
Michael, can I say something?
Yeah, please.
Michael?
Jim Fallows.
So Deborah Sanders saying it hasn't hurt him, and it has hurt him profoundly with black voters. You know, his approval rating with blacks is below 5% in most polls. So, you know, I think absent the whole birtherism, you might have expected the Democrats to have lower support among blacks once Barack Obama is not running again. But I think birtherism has profoundly hurt him with a significant part of the electorate.
And here's Tony.
You're right.
Good morning.
You're right.
Good morning. How are you? My comment is something that they did discuss that was substantive. If it had to do with how we're going to keep our streets safer, Donald Trump gave the option of stop and frisk. And even though it's been considered unconstitutional, I don't think that stopping and frisking everybody would be unconstitutional. However, Hillary, on the other hand, was discussing the fact that people could be trained because of their implicit bias. I don't really feel that it's implicit bias. It's the explicit bias. It's, you know, some of the texts that you've seen from some of the San Francisco cops and some of the Oakland cops, that's not implicit. That's explicit. So as a person of color, I would prefer the massage rather than the death sentence.
Well, Tony, thank you for your I'm glad to hear your opinion here. It's in contrast probably with a lot of the listeners, but I thought we could hear what happened last night on this score. While Donald Trump talked about needing stop and frisk in communities, Lester Holt pointed out its unconstitutionality.
Stop and frisk was ruled unconstitutional in New York because it largely singled out black and Hispanic young men.
No, you're wrong. It went before a judge who was a very against police judge. It was taken away from her, and our new mayor, refused to go forward with the case. They would have won an appeal. If you look at it, throughout the country, there are many places
where the argument is that it's a form of racial profiling.
No, the argument is that we have to take the guns away from these people that have them and that are bad people that shouldn't have them.
And he turned that, Bruce Cain, into an argument, an NRA argument, basically. But the fact of the matter is, I think he's dead wrong on the constitutional question, isn't he?
Well, yes, in the sense that there was a court that ruled against it. So, I mean, but I'm not sure that that's the point. I mean, it's the phrase law and order. It's the you have two things going on. There's no question that over the last 20 or 30 years, the violent crime rate has gone down drastically. And the analyses suggest that it's much greater than any one city's policy. But what has happened and what Trump can use is the fact that violent crime seems to be spiking up a little bit as compared to the in recent years. So, I'm not sure that the law and order that I don't think your average citizen is as worried about walking around the streets as Trump is saying. But I think it conflates with the problem of terrorism, that conflates with the issue of whether or not we're going to have Syrian refugees that are going to start doing to us what's happening in Paris and elsewhere. So,
which surprisingly, excuse me, Bruce, nobody mentioned last night.
Yeah,
I was surprised by that,
yeah.
Too.
Right.
Let me go back to the question of race with you, Jim Fallows. So, I mean, a lot depends, obviously, on turnout in terms of how things do turn out in this election. And the real point you made, I think, was a telling point about the way African-Americans are still angry about the birther thing. And yet, are they going to turn out and support Hillary Clinton?
So let's again step back and look at the big picture of what this debate would or would not do in the election, that each candidate has his or her respective base, and they don't really need to court them that much, although Donald Trump spent a lot of his time courting his. And the question is whether Donald Trump will be able to expand in areas where he is now weak, that is among blacks, among Latinos, among women, among Muslims, among millennials, and among highly educated people. And so I think that if you think of those groups one by one, I think there's nothing he said that would make Muslim Americans less likely to vote for him than before. But in almost all the others of these groups, you could see his comments and deportment last night making it easier for these people to think, okay, I will actually show up and vote against him. I think for blacks in particular, where when the subject of crime and urban life came up, sort of the two ways in which Trump filled airtime in the next couple of minutes, one was the whole stop and frisk business, which at least on the East Coast is seen as an obviously unconstitutional thing. And crime in New York has gone down since the end of stop and frisk policies. And the other was then segueing into the birther controversy. So I think that builds enthusiasm against him. So again, if Donald Trump to win needs to expand his franchise and support and enthusiasm among blacks, women, Latinos, Muslims, millennials, educated people, it's hard for me to see how he made progress with any of those groups.
You mentioned in the piece you did that appeared today, James Fallows, about Trump's talking about tearing up agreements and actually saying we should have, as far as the Iraq war was concerned, we should have essentially taken the oil. This appeals to a certain kind of, bread and circus or whatever you want to call it in terms of a lot of his supporters, but especially when he even inveighs against the Iran treaty. How much of that wins him over even more those who might be on the fence but who are inclined to agree?
So my sense is, again, for the people who already support him, this is yet more reason to support him. But I've done a lot of reporting over the years and recently in the military, and two of the things that are most anathema about Trump within the military are, number one, a claim he's made often but didn't do last night, which is that we really got to bring back waterboarding and more torture-type techniques than that. The other is taking the oil from invading Iraq. On torture, that is something you will find – all you have to do is imagine John McCain's position on this to think more broadly of the military. This is not something for which there's a lot of support in the military. In terms of taking the oil, number one, actually taking it is something that is a little more complex than it sounds. And this is, in the view of every professional military officer in a position of responsibility, it would be illegal and even a war crime. This is not something the United States is supposed to do, is, you know, sort of plundering the assets of other countries. So I think this revs up the base but does not expand his reach, which, again, if he does not expand his reach and his support, he cannot win.
Again, James Fallow, national correspondent for The Atlantic, and another caller joining us. Bruce, you're on. Morning.
Thanks. I was just really turned off by both people. I thought Donald Trump tried to pretend to raise his intellect to some level that we could understand, and unfortunately Hillary seemed to think that she should lower hers to meet Donald Trump somewhere in the middle, and it was just horrible to watch. And none of them really had any policies that I could understand. Trump wants to raise lower taxes on the rich, which has never worked to create jobs. Hillary wants to raise taxes on the rich, which will never add up to any kind of income. And that's just to address the government budget. It doesn't really affect jobs, which the real problem is wages. They both had crazy ideas like profile and frisk for Trump, you know, which doesn't work because the cops aren't shooting gang members who are unarmed. They're shooting people who don't have guns. So Hillary wants to do more sensitivity training and think about the problem really, really hard and see if she can come up with a solution. These aren't answers. And the foreign policy, Trump wants to start another war in the Middle East with a country that we won't be able to win. And Hillary thinks that the idea of cutting the head off of the snake is the only solution that ever works, even though Al-Qaeda is still alive and well, even though Bin Laden was taken out. So I'm done. I'm going to vote for the third party because in California I can throw my vote away without too much of a burden on my conscience. And I'm going to go for the third party. I don't know if it's going to be the Green or if it's going to be Johnson or Stein, but I'm going to focus on them because they seem to be sane, they seem to be reasonable, and they seem to have plans that actually address the reality we live in.
All right, Bruce, I appreciate your call. Another disillusioned voter who is unhappy with both candidates and didn't find much to change that last night. Deborah Sonnis, back to you, though, because the first thing he talked about was taxes. And, you know, Trump was very emphatic about cutting taxes, job creation. This is a standard Republican line, really. And Hillary Clinton was talking about taxing the rich, which appeals again to the Democrats and the Bernie Sanders supporters. So the lines were clearly drawn. But that caller also mentioned the fact that, traditional Democrat-Republican lines, he also mentioned the fact that they seem short on solutions. And again, this has been a widespread criticism.
Boy, I have to say, one thing the caller really hit on is I have so many friends who are thrilled California doesn't count. Who are conservatives, they're voters in California and thinking, it doesn't matter who I vote for. They've never been happier because we know how the state's going to go, so they can make their choice not feeling a lot of weight on their shoulders.
Well, unless there's an October surprise or something along those lines. I mean, you never know.
I think in this debate, and I think the other thing that the caller got right was nobody's really trying to push their point of view. They're just sort of sticking. It's not a race. It's demolition derby. Right, you're not watching to see who's going to drive the car the fastest and get through. You're trying to see which car inflicts the most damage, which driver on the other car. I do want to go back to one thing, which is crime, which is something that Trump talked about yesterday. The new FBI statistics came out: murder up about 10%, violent crime is up as well. Second year where that's shown. Now, you'll hear people talk about how crime is at historic lows. There's a sense, especially here in California, where we've had a lot more reforms in other states, that things are changing now. And I think that that's something that Trump has tapped into. And people are talking about the same thing in New York City. So I appreciate the points that are made on the historic lows. The question is that about to change and change for the worst?
And we'll go to more of your phone calls. And thank you for waiting. Ramona, you're on with us. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you. I just wanted to make two quick points, if I could. And one is about Trump and one is about the press. James Fallows was talking about Trump's desire to plunder the assets of other countries should we get in a war with them. And I just wanted to make the point that above all, the thing that seems to animate and energize this man is revenge. This has been documented throughout his life. And I think the most telling moment for me in this entire sordid campaign season was when he won the Republican nomination. He won it after the Indiana primary. He was the victor, and the next day is when he brought up about Cruz's father and some story in the National Enquirer, Cruz's father assassinated Kennedy. That's kicking a corpse. That is very, very disturbing. And maybe I am a starry-eyed patriot, but this country is not about revenge against our enemies. And when I think of the people in my parents' generation who fought formidable enemies in Japan and Germany and suffered and then came home and gave their tax money to rebuild Europe and Japan, I moved to tears that we have moved so far away from that.
Ramona, thank you for that call. I appreciate hearing from you. And I'm going to go back to you, Bruce Kane, on this, the nuclear issue. And Trump is being vindictive. These are certainly things that you could see last night and how do they affect the voters?
Yeah, I think of all the elections that I've witnessed in my adulthood, you'd have to go back to sort of the Nixon election where there was an express concern about using power inappropriately and, getting revenge on enemies. And I think I haven't heard this before. I never heard it with Romney or I never heard it with Bush. And it's a very strong theme. It's a strong theme in the Jewish community. There are even Jewish conservatives that are very concerned about this kind of authoritarianism that Trump has in his personality, his willingness to think about using his power to get after enemies or people that have insulted him in the past. And whether that generalizes into a broad problem when we finally get the election is another matter, because what we've discovered across the world is that when people are feeling insecure, that very authoritarianism, which is so problematic in the ways that your listener described, to some people, that's an assurance that somebody, some strong daddy is going to take care of them. And how that plays out, I think, will depend partly on what kind of events happen between now and Election Day.
Well, let me go to you on this, Jim Fallows. I've said a few times on the air, especially since 9/11, the idea of a strong leader, and particularly in the wake of things like Orlando and San Bernardino, is very appealing. Somebody who's tough. Bruce calls it a strong daddy. And that is a big factor in elections, as is likability. Trump may not be the most likable candidate, but certainly he may be perceived as the strongest candidate, despite his, susceptibility to vindictiveness.
Sure. And the long saga of American history is a balance between the strength needed at the center of power, as Alexander and Hamilton and others were arguing long ago, and the democratic checks necessary to keep that from being taken out of bounds. And I think something that is distinctive about Trump in his personal presentation. I was at the Cleveland Convention where he gave this speech with the astonishing line, you know, only I under, you know, the system is broken in ways that only I understand and I alone can fix it, which is not something you would imagine FDR or Abraham Lincoln or Dwight Eisenhower or John Kennedy saying.
And forgive me, Jim, I know more than anybody about ISIS. I mean,
yes,
you know, it's a remarkable statement.
The generals. Mm-hmm. And the other is that I think this public presentation is related to something striking in his personality. In my current story in The Atlantic, I have long discussions about the authoritarian and humiliation and revenge theme of Donald Trump's public and private life. And lots of it is an impressive constant in how he views people. And so to have that kind of personality matched with the unparalleled powers of the American presidency is the reason I personally do not want to have him any closer to power than he is now.
And also a lot of likability has to do with humility, even if it's sort of a self-effacing kind of faux humility, don't you think, Jim?
Well, to pursue this one round more, I also talk in my article about the video that I think is the heart of the 2016 election, which is a couple of years ago. It's Donald Trump shaving Vince McMahon's head in a wrestling ring. The two of them had a bet on a wrestling match. They're both pro wrestler promoters then. And it is this incredible emasculation ritual where Trump has Vince McMahon's head in a headlock. He's shaving off all of his hair. It's not something you can imagine Dwight Eisenhower doing.
And remember, Jimmy Fallon actually running his hand through Donald Trump's hair. But let me – Donald Trump's hair seems to be on many people's minds, perhaps more than it should be. But I'm going to go to more of your calls here. Let's get Lewis on next. Lewis, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
Well, my point is a little different, and I'm going to change the subject. I mean, the misconception that a business person can run a government is totally two different things. You cannot measure government the same way you measure business because you have investments in it. Some of the stuff are going to be in short term, some are going to be in long term, develop. It's a lot of things that has to do really in the same way we see materialistically running a business. Government is more than just invest money.
Lewis, I'm appreciative of that call because I want to go to Deborah Saunders in this. You know, part of the appeal of Trump to many people was the appeal Ross Perot had, but even on steroids to some extent. You know, he's a great businessman, which is questionable in itself, but therefore he is, well, not only perhaps appropriately in a leadership role, but can run a country.
I know. And really, we've seen this in California in so many elections where business people have tried to run for governor. And over time, you got the feeling that the California legislature would just destroy them. We saw that with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he came in with so much verve and strength. And over time, they just undercut him left and right. You know, I think one of the appeals and what James was saying about the shaving that Donald Trump did is people look at Donald Trump and they think he's my friend and he's on my side. And the day comes, I think, for everyone when they realize, oh, no, he's going to go after me now. And that's the thing that would wear over time with him. And yet, here he is.
Well, explain to me, perhaps if you can or if any of you can, the populist appeal of someone who was born with a silver spoon. And Hillary Clinton pointed out, you know, got millions from his father. He kind of downplayed that and reduced the amount. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you have a lot of people who are down and out and who are suffering economically who see him as their leader.
And this is where Hillary Clinton is such a problem because she was dead broke when she got out of the White House. And their worth and the Clintons have a net worth. What have they done? They've been in public service. That's what they always call it, $128 million. She is in absolutely no position to hit him. And here's the thing that Trump does that's brilliant. He enjoys his money. People I know have a lot of money. They're conflicted about it. They're in anguish. They're not enjoying it. He takes people for rides in his private jet. That's what he was doing in Iowa. He's saying to people, yes, I've got money and I enjoy it and it's fun and I'm getting something out of it. Whereas if you give it to the government, they're going to squander it. And so I think that a lot of people, they think if I had money, I'd be like Donald Trump. And that really works. They can imagine being happy with their money like Trump more than they can imagine being Bill Gates.
It's like all the people who dream they're going to win the lottery almost on some level. I'm going to read a pro-Trump email from Maria who says, Trump did talk some specifics. Why is it okay for Mexico to tax our goods at 16%? How does that help working Americans? How about corporations leaving the U.S. because of a 30% corporate tax? But that discussion went nowhere. Clinton offered zero specifics on policy, mostly generalities. Deborah Saunders?
That's true.
And it's also true that he hit her hard, let me go to you on this, Bruce Kane, on TPP, well, NAFTA as well, but that was on her husband's watch. But TPP and the flipping on TPP was something that he really kept bringing up. He said, you called it the gold standard and all the rest of that. He made points on that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did with a certain constituency. I mean, it is ironic, of course, that the party that was in favor of free trade is the Republican Party. The Democrats, since Clinton, have been more in consistent with that. But still, I think it's an important thing for her to think about going into the next two debates. How is she going to get back to these issues of trade? How is she going to talk about TPP, NAFTA, and about these communities that got left behind? Because the reality is, people talk the talk about doing things about these Rust Belt states, but both parties didn't walk the walk. They didn't really do anything to address these problems in a serious way. And I think she really needs to answer that. She was asked to do that in the primary, and she didn't really do it there. But she really has to do it if she wants to try to win over some of those voters in those Rust Belt states like Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Seconds left, James Fallows. What does Trump have to do?
I guess if he agrees with me, at least, he needs to expand the draw. Then in the next debate, which is a town hall, I guess finding ways to temper things that would alienate blacks, Latinos, and women, and find ways to appeal to them.
I thank you, James Fallows from The Atlantic, and Bruce Kane from Stanford, and Deborah Saunders from The Chronicle. Glad to have had you all aboard, and thank you, our callers and listeners. We have another hour coming up. We're going to talk to Tracy Kidder in the hour ahead about his new book, A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. Please feel free to join us for that. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our general manager is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for being a part of this opening hour. Join us in another one. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.